There was only one wild card game three, but oh boy, did Mets Brewers make up for it. An absolute stunner in the Cream City. We will talk all about the Mets victory over the Brewers and preview all four division series, three of which live up to their name. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world intent on calling this the multiplication series, because that's how much excitement there is. I'm Jake Mintz, that's Jordan Schusterman, and who needs to know how to divide?
The question is, Jake, will this be a long division series? I hope so. I would like, honestly, I'm so excited for these series that the fact that they can only max out at five games is a little bit of a bummer. On this Friday edition of Baseball Barbacast, we are recording this late on Thursday night, but you are listening to this on Friday, where there is no baseball. This is hopefully the last day for, well, I'll probably have a couple more days without baseball later on in October, but take a breather. Enjoy this podcast as we review Game 3 between the Mets and the Brewers and look ahead to what should be an absolutely delicious collection of four division series that we have on the schedule.
But first, we must review. Because tonight, Thursday night, we were gifted just an unforgettable baseball game. One that will stick in my craw, in my mind, and certainly in the minds of Brewers fans and Mets fans for a long time to come. Let's set the stage. Mets, Brewers, the power of Grimace versus college baseball skipper Pat Murphy and his fighting Brewers. Game one goes to the Mets. Game two goes to the Brewers, a late comeback. And it all came down to game three. And yes, it delivered. Jose Quintana for the Mets, the soft-tossing lefty against Tobias Myers, a hard-throwing youngster for the Milwaukee Brewers, who should and will get some down-ballot Rookie of the Year votes.
This was a pitching matchup that when we briefly previewed it 24 hours ago, we were like, I was like, I don't know, this could get sloppy. This could be a barrage of home runs. But instead, the pitchers were locked in and the batters were, which is, you see this oftentimes in an elimination game, the batters were a little bit tight, but these pitchers were rolling, and we rolling to the point where we can probably fast forward through their outings immediately.
But what was great about the early going was how differently they were doing it. Mm-hmm. Tobias Myers was electrifying. He was a night out on the town, one with your pals that you remember and joke about for a long time. Jose Quintana, on the other hand, was the equivalent of a sensational nap. And I mean that as a compliment. The type where you pass the hell out, you wake up, and it's 2 hours later, and it's in the sixth inning, and no one has scored a run.
Yeah. And, you know, Quintana, right, he's maxing out at 92, 93. Tobias Myers was throwing harder than really we had seen, at least on average, for most of the season, touching 95, 96. And again, like you mentioned, you woke up and suddenly it was the sixth inning and it was 0-0. And you're thinking, oh my gosh, like this is still an elimination game and someone's going to have to score at some point.
Seventh inning, bottom of the seventh inning. Out goes Quintana and in goes Joey Butts. Jose Buto, Mets reliever, started the year in the rotation, since moved to the bullpen. And up to the plate to face him strolls Jake Bowers, a gentleman whom has my name earlier this year in an attempt to send myself a workout plan. I typed Jake into the bar on my phone and I clicked the first thing that popped up and it was Jake Bowers. And I sent Jake Bowers my workout plan and he responded, thanks. We'll give it a look. He homered that day. And one can only believe that what he accomplished against the Mets tonight was because of the washed-up D3 baseball workout plan that I sent his way. Jake Bowers, in the first at-bat against Jose Buto, sends one deep and gone. The first run of the game, Jake Bowers, who is hitting under 200, but still having a relatively productive season. He gets on base. He hits for some good pop. 1-0 Brewers. AmFam. Rocking, popping, The Brewers can smell it. A team that has suffered so much postseason sadness over the last few years can taste the next round, a trip to Philadelphia. And it gets even closer when the next batter on the first pitch, Sal Frelick, who on Rosh Hashanah I accidentally called Sol Frelick, rips one way gone for the hardest hit ball of his season. This is a player Jordan, who had not homered.
I mean,
since May 15th.
Yes, he had the longest homerless drought in baseball comfortably because he had been playing regularly for Milwaukee and he was hitting home runs was not his thing. His thing is putting the ball in play and running the bases and playing good defense. But in this case, you know, I mentioned last night talking about Garrett Mitchell, how what this team really has lacked, especially since Christian Yelich went down, is left-handed power that is just non-existent in this Brewers lineup to get these two swings. And what did we talk about last night? A reliever allowing two home runs in a postseason game. And here we are again, Jose Buto. It was just like to these two guys, right? You know, not even you know, Churio and Garrett Mitchell, who have been much better hitters over the course of the season. It was unbelievable. And yeah, Frelick, who again has like basically the lowest amount of power, the least amount of power of any regular player in the bear, or at least bottom two or three, for him to hit a ball, you know, over 400 feet and I think 108 off the bat, he's never done that before in the major leagues, was unbelievable.
And when they score those two runs, it feels over, just considering how lost the Mets offense had looked all night and how successful the Brewers bullpen has been all season. You know that Devin Williams is lingering in the ninth inning. He's been totally locked down really his whole career. And so when it goes to the eighth and the Mets can't do anything against Freddy Peralta, who started game one, you just feel like this one is going to kind of drift away and the OMG Grimace Mets will just be a footnote in our mind's eye. Let's quickly talk about Freddy Peralta.
Sure.
Great managerial move. Peralta, the Brewers' best starting pitcher who started game one, only threw around 68, 69 pitches, I believe, in that game. Bring him back on 2 days rest. He was going to throw a bullpen today anyway. Great little sneaky move by
One
day rest. Great little sneaky move by Pat Murphy, who is at the heart of it all, a college baseball coach. This is the type of thing that every good college coach would do.
Yeah, and right, Peralta was very much not happy after that situation. I mean, he wasn't like
in game one.
Yeah, after game one, like, and they lose that game, and he was like, he didn't chew out Murph publicly, but like he was asked his feelings about it, and he basically was like, "I'd rather not say." Like, you could tell Peralta was super disappointed in that decision, and so to put him back out in that spot, which obviously he wanted that ball, and give them just that one inning, because he just had to give them that one inning, right? You just got to get it to Devin Williams. He gives them the 1-2-3 inning, getting Marte, Taylor, and Alvarez. Bottom of the eighth, Diaz, who had come in, we should mention, after Buto, he gets through the eighth cleanly, and then here comes Devin Williams with a 2-run lead. Which, even with the top of the lineup coming up with Lindor leading off, you still got to be feeling pretty good because Devin Williams is one of the best relievers on earth. And since he's been back from injury, he has been fantastic.
The Francisco Lindor walk, that's what Will looks like. The way he works that at bat, there was one pitch, I have to go back and watch it, but it's like high heat up in the kitchen and he fouls it back with two strikes. And in that moment, Francisco Lindor, who, by the way, a couple days ago, like couldn't touch his freaking toes because of his back. I don't know what good drugs they...
At this point, he's healthy. I mean, now he's the way that he's moving on all, great. In every way, he is absolutely fine.
What a player.
Again, eight pitch walk, right? He holds off on the check swing. And we got something cooking. But then Mark Vientos strikes out, which brings us to Brandon Nimmo. Brandon Nimmo, again, really tough end to the season in September. But he had that big home run in Atlanta. And you could tell he was a good matchup for Devin Williams. Even, you know, as amazing as Devin Williams' changeup is, he was on it. He was right on it. And on the third one, he fouled off the first two and he rips the third into right field. And now we have first and third with one out.
And look who's coming up to the plate. Pete Alonso with a chance to end the season or give the Mets the lead. Now, we should mention that in the eighth inning, there was a key moment in which Alonso dropped
seventh inning. Because there were still runners on base. It was second and third. And I think it was Contreras, right? Contreras was up two outs in second and third. And at this point, you know, the Brewers had already taken a 2-0 lead, but a foul pop right kind of past the dugout.
Easy to catch. Yeah, easy catchable base. Ball. And It just clonks off of Alonso's glove, tumbles to the ground. And they pan to him. He says a four-letter word that starts with F very clearly. And that image of him dropping that pop-up felt like potentially the last moment of Pete as a Met, right? Yeah. Which would have been unfortunate. Producer Andrew Hartz was at Citi Field for this moment and said to us that basically people were ready to burn jerseys. Like, it was tear down the pictures of Polar Bear all around the stadium, get him out of here in free agency. He's been horrendous over the last couple of weeks. I believe five for his last 38 or something abysmal.
Just strikeouts, terrible. And Pete's saying, he's saying, oh, I feel good. I feel good. Just waiting for that result. It's like, you don't look good. You know, it was not looking good. Of course, I understand him staying positive. That's fine. But like, it was not looking good. He was not giving us reasons to think there was a big swing coming. Now, Diaz bails him out. Diaz strikes out Contreras. And so it's still two runs. But that is still looming.
But then Pete comes up with runners on first and third and one out. And it's like, he just rolls over a ball. I mean, he's not fleet of foot. Or nor hand, nor leg. There is no fleetness in his body.
No.
He rolls one over. That's double play. That's the season. Thanks for coming. That's the maybe the career, the tenure of Alonso and Queens. And I'm watching this game at home, my parents' house, with my cousin and my aunt and uncle who live in New York and who are all Mets fans. Okay? And I turn to him and I say, you see how this is going to go, right? And he goes, I see how it's going to go. And I said, but what if he does? And he goes, what if he does? And Pete did. Pete Alonso, okay? Let's talk about him as a character for a second. Pete is a dork. Pete's a bit of a doofus. I don't mean that in a negative way. Pete is jolly. Pete is not like every other professional baseball player. Pete is not cool, I would say. Pete is not particularly cool. Even after he rips this home run, his celebration around the bases is like adorable more than it is exhilarating, if that makes sense, right? And for Pete, who his entire time in Queens has been living in the shadow of his rookie season, which was, he's never been that good in a regular season since he came up in 2019. And for him to have this moment, hitting a Devin Williams changeup on the outer half, lasering it over the fence in right field, over the outstretched jump of Sol Frelich for a three-run ding-dong, giving the New York Mets the lead. It was gasp-inducing.
That's exactly right. I gasped. I kind of, not shrieked, but like, I like kind of, had to, I emitted some noise that was not, you know, it's not excitement, right? Because we're not Mets fans, but it's just like the, oh my God. It's like, I've been saying all season, as we've been spending all of our time totally understandably talking about Francisco Lindor, that at some point the focus would turn back to Pete Alonso. As his free agency got nearer and nearer with every game, and as the Mets postseason odds went up and down and up and down and up and down, and Pete's playing worse and worse and worse as the Mets season is coming down, and it's like, we're still having a good time because the Mets have this amazing chance and everyone's having fun and Lindor is amazing and all these things. But at some point, we're going to still be talking about Pete Alonso because he was the story coming into this Mets season. And for it to come back around to him and for us Yeah, I mean, boy, there are a lot of even though that drop pop-up didn't end up leading to more runs, just the 15 minutes afterwards was just
he was a villain.
Smell you later. It was like thanks for nothing, Pete. You know, like it's not hard to find those tweets. And then to do this, to hit this go-ahead home run, the first opposite field home run Devin Williams has ever allowed to a right-handed hitter, was, again, only possible when you have the kind of just raw strength that he does. And it was unbelievable. So that's just one of the most incredible postseason home runs we've ever seen. But the Mets were not quite done. Iglesias grounds out, so now it's two outs. But the Mets, they were not, again, they were like, listen, let's go ahead and get us some insurance here, because who in the world is going to close this game out? So Jesse Winker gets hit by a pitch. He steals second. And then Starling Marte drives him in for that oh-so-wonderful additional bit of cushion as the Mets are now up 4-2. Jesse Winker slams his helmet at home plate.
And breaks it.
Shatters it, right? I mean, there seemed to be some shrapnel there.
Hey, quickly. So I'm listening to a book right now about the beginning of the Civil War. Really great read called Demon of Unrest by Eric Larson.
Great
and
listen.
In that book, great listen. Thank you. I learned that shrapnel is named after a dude named Shrapnel.
No shot.
Yeah, dude.
Like Tommy Lieutenant, Shrapnel?
Lieutenant Henry Shrapnel. A British Army officer is why it's called Shrapnel.
Now, again, this could get graphic, or I don't want to be
he just invented it. Like, he was like, let's put a bunch of stuff in, like, cannons, and it'll, right, like, explode and kill more people. And right, that was in the Hank. 18 whatevers. Hank Shrapnel.
Shrapnel.
So there That's you go. Amazing. Learned something today. Yeah.
Thank you. All right. Very educational. Anyway, here comes
this
Joe Ross.
This is why you listen to Baseball Barbacast.
Joe Ross comes in, ends the inning. Tyrone Taylor, former Brewer, flies out. And now, one of the best things in any postseason situation, right?
Who's pitching now?
Is who's pitching now? But they did pan to the bullpen, and we saw David Peterson, who even in the game two was rumored to possibly be available out of the bullpen. He started the game in Milwaukee on Sunday to help the Mets keep their season alive, basically.
Yeah.
David Peterson, who has pitched in relief before, but has never attempted a save, I don't think ever. He had no saves to his name at any point in his career. So this was not certainly
nigh a save to the Peterson name. And it starts rocky as, again, Rabbi Sol Freilich leads off with a single. And you're like, here come the Brewers. And was this going to be one of those wild postseason games where both teams are just punching each other in the face over and over again, like we had Mets Braves at the end of the year? That's not how it goes. Not one bit. Because Mr. Peterson strikes out Joey Ortiz and gets Bryce Turang to ground into a unbelievable double play from Francisco Lindor, scoops it up, touches second base in one swift motion, like a man with two healthy backs, fires it to first base, and wins the game for the Nueva York Mets as Jackson Chourio lingers on deck for the opportunity he will have to wait for. Good thing he's only 12 years old.
Bryce Turang is not slow. And no. Francisco Lindor was not very close to second base. This was an incredible double play. And I know we take Lindor for granted in every sense at this point, but this was yet another moment for him that it had to be. And also a shocking, like, so fast, right? Any game ending double play like this, but for one player to make that happen was just amazing. And the Brewers have had some tough ones lately. They have had some tough ones in this here postseason. And you can add this here to the list as the Mets, the OMG Mets, are moving on to face the Phillies for the first time in the postseason. Anything else on this game before we take a break and then preview this here NLDS between the Phillies and the Mets?
I'm watching this Lindor playback. He's eight steps from the base. He's eight steps from the base.
Wait, Bryce Turang, like 95th percentile sprint speed.
That guy can fly. Hitter. You know, and Acuna is like pretty far away from the bag because of how they're shifting Turang, who's a left-handed hitter, second baseman, right? And so you end up with a situation where the only play is for Lindor to run it over and just
and incredible again, stuff. I hadn't even thought about Churio being on deck, but that's, you know, makes this play all the more incredible, right? With Peterson. I know Stanek was warming up, so I would imagine they would have gone to Stanek for Churio, but who cares? Who cares?
Brewers. I can't imagine any Brewers fans are listening right now. Why would you ever want to listen to baseball content?
Yeah. I have no idea how the Packers are doing, but I hope they're doing better than this.
Yeah. Maybe the Milwaukee Admirals are having a good season in the second level.
And I
of
know,
hockey.
Right? Bucks training camp is already off to a weird start. So I don't know what to tell you fans if you are listening. This
heck
is
of a
just
year.
Brutal. And that's the postseason, right? A lot of teams are going to go home sad. That's going to happen again for a bunch more over these next few weeks.
But so far, no fan base is going home sadder.
Yeah. I mean, more crushed, right? Again, every postseason exit kind of has a slightly different flavor. But this one's going to hurt. This one's going to hurt for a while because it really did feel like when they did win that second game, when they did have those moments with those two home runs from Jake Bowers and Saul, and now I'm saying Saul because you've been saying Saul. Sal Frelick.
Look how far you hit the ball.
You don't lose this game where you have back-to-back homers from Bowers and Frelick. Like, come on.
Yeah.
They did. So, they tough. Did. Bye, Brewers.
Good news. Yeah. Jackson Churio might be one of the best, like, 10 to 15 players in baseball.
He could just be an MVP candidate next year. So
be on your team
again,
until we all die.
As we've said about, again, there's still, like, who... But then they have, like, what they have coming is there's some exciting stuff on the mound coming. So still a bright future in Milwaukee. It was a fun season, but this is a tough one. This is going to be a really, really tough one to deal with for a while.
Let's take a break. And when we return, we'll talk about those Mets and how they match up with the Philadelphia Phillies. And what if I told you that was the second most tantalizing NLDS matchup? Welcome back, Baseball Barbacast. Jake Minshew, Schusterman. You know, sitting around TV with my family on Rosh Hashanah, watching the Mets play. I mean, now that's how you observe the high holidays. My cousin made a note that chugga 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 really is not the proper sound for the narrative machine. They liked ka-ching 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 more, but we got an email from someone who said it should be more like a ring tink ka tink like a ring ring ka tink ka tink ka tink. So we're gonna go ahead and boot that narrative machine up for the Phillies and the Mets. Now this is the first time these two have played in the postseason. And the proximity here is what should take this to a whole another level. There is no love lost between these two fan bases located, I would gander, 119 miles away from one another, give or take.
You would know better than anybody. So I'm trusting your estimate on that. But I would just say that this is, you know, we have three, right, division matchups here in this DS round. But for all the energy that we have devoted, how close were you with 119 miles?
117 miles.
Between stadiums?
Yeah, just built different. Good. Sorry about that.
Built different Oregon. My apologies. Done that drive however many times.
My apologies.
I mean, just all the energy we've devoted towards thinking about the Braves and the Phillies, you know? That's just like all we've thought about for, it's not that, you know, when the Mets and Phillies have played over the last three seasons, we haven't thought it was fun, but for 3 years, we've been thinking about the Mets or the Braves and the Phillies. Right. And now it's like, oh my God, the Mets and the Phillies. Okay. You know, it's not like, again, it's just, this is every bit as juicy for a lot of reasons. And especially because of just the New York plus Philly fan base, which is different than the Philly plus Atlanta fan base, because, you know, there's just a lot more going on there, which is pretty exciting.
Big winner of this series, Amtrak. Big winner of this series, baseball, trying to get people to care about baseball in London. And that's why I'd like to begin here, because remember, weird season series between these two teams. The Phillies and the Mets played in London, and that kind of split up their first early series of the season because they both had technically lost a home game when they went over to London. They split there. They split some of the games earlier on in the season. The Phillies took 3 out of 4, like winning both in Queens. They split in Philly. It was just bizarre, okay? But the reason that these matchups are a little relevant is they played a lot towards the end of the season. Remember, Phillies took 2 out of 3 in Philly in mid-September, winning, I believe, both games on one game on a walk-off, another game on a late comeback. This was the Cal Stevenson home run robbery, RBI double, right? And then the Mets take 3 out of 4 in Queens, preventing the Phillies to clinch, winning that really dramatic game on Sunday Night Baseball. I was at all four of those. And so these two teams have seen a lot of one another recently, and I think that's going to add a nice layer on the bottom of our skillet.
Yeah, and the recently is relevant because we'll have some other examples when we talk about Guardians Tigers later, where they haven't played since, you know, July. Whereas the these versions of these teams, particularly the Mets, who just the version we've seen over the last, you know, 2 months, is very different than the one we saw earlier in the season.
But
so
the Phillies
feels more representative.
They have seen this version.
Yeah.
Right? The Phillies have seen this version of the Mets.
And it didn't always go great for the Phillies.
Spanked by them in Queens. One other narrative I want to hook on here is Zach Wheeler against the Mets in October. Wheeler, who was with the Mets for a long time, who signed a big contract with the Phillies in 2020 after that season. And there were the quotes from Mets leadership at the time about how they, you know, the Mets felt like they helped Zach Wheeler.
From Brody. Let's be clear about who that was from, right? But
not current Mets leadership, both new team owner and new GM, but Wheeler clearly cared about that, right? Something he thought about. I don't believe he's like mad at David Stearns or Steve Cohen, but it is certainly in the back of the mind and is going to be fun to watch him compete against the team he spent a lot of time with. And that will allow us to preview these starting pitching matchups because Zach Wheeler, who will finish as the runner-up for Cy Young, maybe he'll win it. Probably not. He'll throw game one for the Phils against Luis Severino for the Mets, probably. We believe game two, we think, will be David Peterson against definitely Aaron Nola. Game three, Sean Manaea against Christopher Sanchez in a battle of wrong-handers. What stands out to you here, Jordan?
So, yeah, and maybe we're slightly off about the Mets lineup here. Now, one key thing about the National League rounds is that there's no off day on Sunday, so you know they're staggering it, so everything starts on Saturday, but then the National League are playing their game twos on Sunday, whereas the AL gets an immediate off day, so there's some a little bit more pitching flexibility for the AL team. So but to your point, I expect to see Severino and Peterson and Manaea, and then obviously Quintana just looked great, so maybe there's more confidence, you know, going to Quintana in a potential game four if they don't feel comfortable going to Severino on shorter rest there.
Now, the one X factor here is Kodai Senga, who has a chance to be on the Mets playoff roster, reportedly via Mike Puma. Now, Senga has pitched just once this season. He has battled injuries all season long. I can't imagine he would start any games, but he could be available out of the bullpen.
Which reminds me of Tylor Megill's existence. That's someone who was not available during this wildcard series, was not on the roster because he had pitched on Monday in Atlanta, but he's also almost certainly going to be a candidate to start maybe even the third or fourth games, depending on how they match up there. If Senga makes the roster, it's hard to imagine they'd be giving him a start. It'd be more of just someone who they believe in his
can
stuff
get outs.
And can get outs because, I mean, ultimately, this Mets staff is just thin. And so if they feel like there is a pitcher that can help them for any amount of innings, then maybe they'll end up on there. But that still seems, I would still be pretty surprised.
Now, it might be tempting to look at these offenses and give the edge to the Phillies. And if you look at the full season numbers, they're pretty close. But since June 1st, when these Grimace Mets were born, they have been way better than the Phillies. Higher WRC+, more home runs, which somehow feels incorrect, even though it is true. And so the Mets have a bit of an edge on the offensive side if you look solely at the numbers, right? Now, yes, the Phillies, this Phillies group, they have been there time and time again in October. Now, it might not always be a good thing. We saw that at the end of last year in the NLCS, how tight and tense things got when the walls started to cave in on them. And I'll be interested to see what version of the Phillies offense we see. And I think we'll know pretty early. If they get down or it's, you know, a low scoring game early in game one and game two, that's where it begins to be a problem. On the other hand, Kyle Schwarber, we don't like, he could just hit six home runs in the series, right?
Yeah. The ceiling is still very comparable for the Phillies offense. The one difference stylistically is the Phillies can make some noise on the bases in the way that the Mets don't really have that kind of impact speed. I know Lindor, you know, pushing 30 steals, but other than that, like Turner and Stott and you know, even Rojas, if he's getting on, those guys, and the Mets are not awesome at controlling the running game. So there could be some opportunities there. But to your point, that's a pretty large sample where the Mets offense was every bit as productive from, you know, a average and slug standpoint.
X factor in the series.
Man, I don't know. So I'm trying, like, so in terms of the starting pitching, like you lean Phillies there, right? We focus on the order the Mets, whatever order the Mets throw out there, we're going to be leaning pretty heavy towards Philly. I mean, Ranger Suarez feels pretty important.
Bingo.
This was someone who had like a one ERA for the first 2 months and then fell off pretty hard. And especially if they end up throwing Sanchez and Suarez back-to-back starts, I don't know if Wheeler would just come back for game four. I don't know. That seems unlikely. He would maybe be available for a game five. But, you know, Sanchez versus Suarez there is especially if they're throwing Sanchez and Suarez back-to-back starts. Suarez is just an interesting one because he just has not exactly given them what you would really hope for how good he looked early in the season.
He's been a postseason animal for them over the last years, but in his seven starts after coming off the IL, 5.74 ERA, FIP only a run better than that. And he's going to have to almost certainly start game four of the series. So it'll be really interesting to watch him throw. Who throws out the first pitches for this? You know, Reese Hoskins was set to return to Philly with the Brewers, and I think they should just have him throw the first pitch out anyway.
I think Reese is probably going to want to go home and get away from baseball after that situation. Yeah, I don't know. Again, the Phillies have had their fair share of home postseason games here recently. Is there a specific...
Jason Kelce feels like a lock here.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, is there a specific Mets villain, you know, like a former Philly who hit especially well against the Mets would be an
Chase
option.
Utley. Chase Utley.
Again, like that's one where Phillies fans, I'm sure, have great answers.
Could you
for
imagine?
This. I don't think of someone specifically.
The troll level.
Utley is, would be.
For Utley. And then they play the video of him like breaking Ruben Tejada's leg when he's on the Dodgers, right?
Ridiculous. But I'm sure there's some random Phillies. I would love to look this up. I wonder if there's like some like Placido Polanco. Like, did
it's
he
Utley.
Crush the Mets?
It's Utley. It is Utley.
Yeah, but are we? I was going to say, are you burning Utley here?
Yes.
But yeah, sure. Why not?
Yes.
Because
you use
Mets
Utley
Phillies is special. Okay. We'll see.
Smoke him if you got him. Who you got?
Phillies in four. I just think the Phillies are the best team. Like, I think they're the best team in the postseason, not just they're the better team here. Now, we don't know what the hell we're talking about, but I'll stick with the team that the Phillies, I picked the Phillies to win it all. It's a boring pick, and with the chaos we've seen so far, maybe they'll fall on their face with the layoff. I just think they're going to figure it out, and I think they're going to win this.
I'll say Phillies in five. I think it's going to come back down to Wheeler at home in the deciding game, and he'll just shove.
Fair enough. All right. So that's amazing and cool that we have Phillies Mets, with all due respect to the Brewers. However, even though we have seen this next matchup before, in fact, twice, not that long ago, Dodgers-Padres, my friends, is going to be just glorious. And the Padres taking care of business against the very sleepy Atlanta Braves. And
who, by the way, quickly, one last thing on the Braves I didn't say yesterday. The Braves, I don't want to say whining or complaining. The Braves noting that the layoff hurt them for 2 years, only to then not get the layoff, to really get the, opposite of a layoff.
Oh, yeah.
And then go to and thanks for coming.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It's just funny. Anyway, enough about the Braves. They're not here. The Padres are. And now we get to watch Shohei Ohtani in the postseason. That speaks for itself. I don't need to explain that. I don't need to explain why that's important. But I do think that because we have seen these teams match up in the postseason, but as always, with different characters, what we had in 2020 after the Padres had burst onto the scene, right? The Padres lost 90 games in 2019, and then they showed up in that goofy 2020 postseason. It was like, oh my gosh, the Padres, they're here. They've arrived. Tatis, Machado, all these things. But they weren't ready. They were not ready at that point. 2022, they were ready. And that series alone, of course, really set the tone for just where this rivalry was at and reminded us that going into this season, all of those games would be really, really special. And they were. And ultimately, the Padres, they took the season series. They won 8 out of those 13 games. Now, they couldn't quite do it in those last few weeks where we thought they had an outside chance of chasing down the Dodgers for the division. But the Padres have more than held their own against the Dodgers over the last few years and now have this incredible opportunity to do it again and spoil what is going to be a just an if you thought the Ohtani mania has reached a fever pitch, we are just getting started. And by the way, that's the way it should be. Anybody that thinks that MLB is tweeting too much about Ohtani, guess what? They should be tweeting even more about Ohtani because he is the most important person in the sport. And he is the most incredible baseball player we have ever seen. And he did have one of the most amazing seasons we've ever seen. All of those things are true.
And guess what?
You can't, yeah.
Padres fans, it's okay for that to get under your skin.
Great.
It's okay.
Go beat him.
Right?
That's fine. Great. You can beat him.
Yeah.
You can beat him.
Those, all the Ohtani hype should make you mad. It should make you frustrated. But that's what fine. About Jurickson Profar, huh? You don't tweet about him.
Yeah.
And if you look at WRC Plus on Tuesdays,
why did you only give Jake Cronenworth one exclamation point?
Ooh.
Feeling a little jealous. Shohei Ohtani got all caps and 17 exclamation points.
Listen,
there are real people tweeting these things. But the point is, be jealous. That's fine. The point is, Shohei Ohtani is the most important story here because we've been waiting for him to be in the postseason forever. When we finally got to watch him play high stakes game for Teams Japan, how did that go? It was like the coolest thing we've ever seen. So now we get to see him do it for the Dodgers, which I imagine, I know it's not as fun to watch for a neutral fan as him maybe doing it for Japan, even if you really cared about, you know, Team USA. This is still going to be very, very, very special.
Ohtani, down the stretch this year, started to peel back some layers of himself that we really hadn't seen before. He was significantly more emotive on the diamond in big moments than I can remember. And I think that was just a glimpse. If he hits a big homer or drives in a clutch run, we're going to get something abnormal from a player who has been relatively stoic throughout his time in our lives. And I think Ohtani is where we should start here when we compare these offenses. One team has him. One team does not. And I do think that the Padres' offense is really good. They don't have the guy with 50,000 steals and 50,000 home runs.
I think it's fair that, yeah, okay, Ohtani, we haven't seen him show this amount of emotion, but, I mean, it's not that hard to understand why. When has he been playing in a game that has meant remotely as much as we saw in the WBC, not to mention every game for the Dodgers for the whole season, but especially over these last, you know, few weeks. So that part is not surprising. And I think that is the other thing about his season is that Mookie Betts and Freddie Freeman are still on this team and are still really good, But with their injuries and the time missed, like, Ohtani did have to kind of go superhero again for this team.
And Freddie is hurt right
and
now.
And Freddie is hurt. Freddie sprained his ankle, which I'm not even sure we ended up mentioning when we recapped kind of their end of their regular season. But he sprained his ankle in a very weird base running play at the end of their season.
From Juan Toribio, the Dodgers writer at MLB.com, says that if this was any other time of the year, Freddie would go on the IL. He's expected to play. He's expected to be ready. It's not exactly a situation where you can DH the guy, right?
No, that's not an option for the Dodgers of Los Angeles. No.
Right? And so how he looks moving around at first base is something to keep an eye on.
Yeah, and I believe Freddie said that, like, he's never dealt with anything like this, which is not surprising. I mean, this is a guy who's barely missed any games for years. I mean, he missed games this year, and that just had to do with the health of his son. It seems like that's been progressing in a positive direction, which is certainly good to hear. But in general, in terms of his health, he's been just completely durable. So this is a new thing for him to manage at an extremely inopportune time.
I think Luis Arraez is another really interesting character here. And he is such an uncomfortable at bat, really forces you into the strike zone, really forces you to think about him constantly atop that lineup. I know he's not really a power threat, and I know in October having the ability to go yard is important, but the reason I think that Arraez is key is he gets on base and then it's just like clock speeds up on Dodger pitching. How does that impact things moving forward? And I think I kind of want to talk about the pitching here, because there's a bit of a gap. I think that the Dodgers starting pitching, just because of all the injuries, is not really that close to where the Padres are at, especially because the Padres can roll out Cease in game one against Yoshinobu Yamamoto. Game two will be Yu Darvish against Jack Flaherty. Game three will probably be Michael King for the Padres. And I think it'll likely be Walker Buehler for the Dodgers.
Yeah, and we weren't sure if it was originally going to be Flaherty in game one, Yamamoto game two, but, you know, Yamamoto and how much time he's going to need between outings is certainly something we're going to be monitoring in October. So maybe that was part of the calculation. But I just think that Yamamoto is just, I mean, he's just so important, because how long he can go in this first game, like, at his best, he proved it this year. He looks like one of the best pitchers on earth, you know, when he's cooking. So that, as much as we talk about the concerns about Dodgers starting pitching, which I think is valid, he is still capable of giving them a performance like that. And so, and also, this is still a lineup that might give whoever's starting for them a cushion that it doesn't matter, even against these great Padres pitchers. And so that is still the thing we've been wondering about the Dodgers for a while, is can they just outscore their opponents? I think this is still the best lineup in baseball. And so, you know, Freddie's health maybe contributes to that. But I mean, man, like, we're talking about, like, Muncy has been incredible since he came back, right? In the season that Teoscar's had, Will Smith, still one of the best hitting catchers in the league. So just so many options for them. And even guys like Edmund have made them a little bit tougher to pitch to. So it's just going to be there are going to be very few boring plate appearances in this entire series. And that is what is so exciting.
I want to finish with that. I am very happy that I'm not covering this series as a writer, and that I can let the chaos of this consume me. And then I can just kind of open up
at the end of the night,
like, finish working. It's 1-1 in the third, and it's just go time, baby. And it's just go time. I gotta say, kudos to Michael King, because I cannot wait to watch him throw in game three at home in San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that I said that sentence for a Dodgers Padres series, this is just really a credit to Michael King. Who throws the first pitches? Ipe. I think the Dodgers should have Ipe do it. Could you imagine? I mean, you want to get the crowd fired up. Like, you bring Ipe out.
Yeah.
There.
Yeah. And really, again, not just a basic, you know, Ohtani reference, but also, how did this season begin? When did all of that go down?
Korea.
In Korea, right before Dodgers Padres. So, yeah, I don't know. Is Ipe in jail yet? I'm not sure. Probably too soon. Yeah. We might want to save that for maybe when they match up in a few years from now. But anyway, Yeah, I mean Dodgers, there's no shortage of options here.
They should have Dodger legend Clayton Kershaw do it.
Bronny.
Hilarious.
Bronny.
Throwing it out to LeBron. Who you got?
I think I picked the Padres. Again, I'm kind of going in on San Diego here. And I've been pretty consistent with that for the last few weeks. I don't know. The Dodgers are, there's just a version. It's just going to take one, you know, big time starting pitching performance there with that just flips it. And you're just like, oh, duh. We didn't talk really much about the bullpens. I mean, the Padres on paper certainly have the edge, but like Kopech has made a big difference, right? And trying Vesia is awesome. So I think the Dodgers bullpen is probably underrated at this point. And I think that could ultimately close the gap. Still a lot of innings to cover here. So I'm going to go with San Diego in five, but the Dodgers win. Let's not be surprised.
Dodgers in four. Here is why. Yu Darvish worries me. I know he was pretty good coming back off the IL, but it just hasn't been a whole lot of time, and you can see him getting bombed in Dodger Stadium and the injury to Joe Musgrove.
Yeah.
In a game four.
That game makes four me is
uneasy.
Is now right. Would they do Martin Perez? Would they just bullpen a game? You know, they have the guys to try and mix and match it, but it depends how much they use him in those first few games. So that's fine.
Look, I think the gap in the starting pitching quality here, if Musgrove can't go, is closer than we might think. Okay, enough. National League. Let's take a break. And when we get back, we will do the American League, Yankees Royals, and the AL Central Super Bowl. Welcome back to Baseball Barbercast. Jake Mintz, George Schusterman, krunk-a-thunk-a-thunk-a-thunk, as it is said. AL Central supremacy reigns upon this great nation as three of the four teams remaining in the American League are the Royals, the Guardians, and the Tigers. Thanks for coming, a division that we besmirched to the ends of the earth for quite a while, and they deserved it every step of the way. But this year, they came out and they said, no, not today. We are done with your ridicule. We will build ourselves up. And here they are. The Kansas City Royals headed to the Bronx, I believe, via train from Baltimore.
As they should.
Am tracking their way, no free ads, to New York to play the Bronx Bombers in a true David versus Goliath showdown, a team that won a series despite scoring three runs against those total versus a club in the Yankees who I feel very good will score more than three runs in this series.
Yeah, something has gone very wrong. As good as the Royals pitching has been, this is again, if we do the narratives right, I mean, the easiest thing in the world is just Bobby Witt versus Aaron Judge. I mean, I think we all assume that Aaron Judge is going to win MVP, possibly unanimously, and I think that that's reasonable. I think there's a chance Bobby Witt Jr., you know, gets a vote or two there, and that voting is over. But it's not impossible that Bobby Witt Jr. could come in and dominate the series and Aaron Judge could strike out a bunch. That is on the table. It's not going to change anything. It doesn't change the fact that Aaron Judge just had, by WRC Plus, the greatest season we have ever seen from a right-handed hitter. I would not expect him to go totally silent in this, but those two, it is the easiest thing in the world. And especially after, you know, those couple games that we saw from Bobby Witt Jr. in Baltimore, not that he was, you know, hitting a bunch of home runs, you know, it's probably going to probably have to do a little bit more than that. But because he can steal bases, because he can beat out infield hits, because he can play amazing shortstop defense, there are always going to be more opportunities for him to kind of, you know, have those moments. And, you know, Aaron Judge has had some defensive highlights along the way, so maybe he can do that as well. But it's a no-brainer. It's those two who just gave us two MVP-worthy seasons this year in the AL.
I just want to give a little bit of age-related context to Bobby, Okay.
Mm-hmm. I did this when the Yankees got Soto. Are you just comparing him to Judge?
No.
Oh, I thought just thinking about where Judge was at when he was Bobby Witt's age, because it's very different.
Double A, but high A.
Yeah. So anyway, sorry to interrupt. I don't know what direction you were going with it.
The Detroit Tigers, about a month and a half ago, called up a shortstop named Trey Sweeney, who's mm-hmm. been really important for them and been a really good player in kind of how Detroit's kind of solidified some things. Trey Sweeney, bright future, older than Bobby Witt Jr., who has been in the major leagues now for three seasons and put up 9.5 wins this year. He is a child, and he is going to stroll into the most unforgiving cauldron this sport can offer. And he, I guarantee you, is not going to blink. To see a player like that on that stage is what our sport deserves, and I cannot wait to watch it. However, if we're going to compare the offenses, I will give the New York Yankees an edge. Bobby Witt Jr. is the only Royal I feel particularly super duper confident about. Seeing Vinny Pasquantino get on base twice in game two was encouraging, considering what he's been dealing with his thumb. Michael Garcia did some good things with his legs. That. Salvi hit a ball really high. You know, like, there really just wasn't a lot else from the Royals offense against Baltimore. And the pitching is kind of only going to get better from here, because you have to face Gerrit Cole in game one of the series. That is confirmed. Cole will go against Michael Wacha in the opener. Carlos Rodon against Cole Reagans in game two. Just good lefty against lefty. Game three, Seth Lugo, who was really good against the Yankees in both of his outings against them this year, I think will go against either Luis Hill, maybe Clark Schmidt. We'll see how they choose to deploy Schmidt. So, because the AL has the extra off day, you can really get through this with only three starters. And that is why the Royals are a little frisky in this one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, you know, would it be cool if we could see Cole versus Reagans? That sounded weird because his name's Cole Reagans. Yes. Yes, it would be. But it's not like they're punting game one. And Michael Wacha's been really solid. You know, and maybe this is a thing where he can flummox the Yankees offense that hasn't played a baseball game for a week. That's in play. But like we said, it's just offensively, there's just so many more opportunities for the Yankees to just hit a ball over the fence. Now, where the Yankees are going to fall short, again, the way close the gap is maybe a little dramatic because the gap is so gigantic, but it's pretty obvious. The Yankees are a horrific base running team, like truly terrible. Not only do they make terrible mistakes all the time, they also are just not stealing bases. Like, it is a station to station offense still. That is still a problem for this team. But again, they walk a ton and they lead the league in home runs, and with Soto, like, it just becomes so much more of a pain to pitch to. And so while you do have some pockets where Giancarlo is very easy to get out, there's just still so many spots that you could just step on and they just hit a three-run homer and you're losing. And the Royals offense is just not in a position to keep up with games like that. So their pitching is going to have to be pretty much flawless.
Here is the X factor for me. It's game two. Maybe this is rude. I cannot imagine the Royals beating Cole in Yankee Stadium, how he's been pitching. Can they get to Carlos? Because Carlos, remember, the worst start we've ever seen, really ever in the history of ever, was last year at the end of the season in Kansas City against the Royals. And he just got mauled. He's been good. He's been solid. He's given up, I believe, the second most home runs in baseball, tied for it. And so you could, you know, can the Royals get, he's going to give up a bomb, I think. I think Carlos will give up a bomb. He's given up a lot of bombs. Who's on base? How many people? That is the X factor. When Hunter Renfro catches one out in front and hits it off the foul pole, and you know that look Carlos has, like when he gives up a home run, that like he doesn't think he should give up. How many people are on base? How many people are on base when that happens? To me, that is like the whole series. That's the whole series. Because if they win the first, if Yankees win the first two games, you just don't see a road back. And so I think that that very specific moment will define how this goes. I will take the Yankees in four.
I agree. I will also take the Yankees in four. Because, yeah.
I think again, the Royals will win game three, and you know, it'll be cool. And then.
Yeah, Luis Hill just like walks five, and, you know, they just. Then the Yankees offense is like, okay, we'll take this one
tomorrow.
I think that's fine. I'm good with Yankees in four. That sounds about right to me. Who you think's throwing out these first pitches in the Bronx this weekend and I guess on Monday?
George Brett for the Pine Tar incident.
In New York, not in Kansas City.
Yeah, in New York.
Now, again, in Kansas City, we've mentioned now that, you know, Wild Card Series is one venue, but we will be going to the other venue, which will be cool to see postseason baseball back in Kansas City. Yeah, we just saw Mike Moustakas throw out one in Milwaukee. Is he going to be there? I think you got to go Alex Gordon and Hosmer before before we do Moose, but a lot of
the Royals have a lot of legends.
Lorenzo Cain. Oh, I mean, that all of those from the 14 and 15, we could just keep rolling them out. If they keep this run going, so many great picks.
But another lock if they keep winning is Mahomes, who owns this team. Mm. Remember that.
Quite literally. Man. All right. That's the Yankees and the Royals.
Now, I'm going to tell a quick story. I will be at the Yankees game one and game two. Yes. Quick story. When we opened the doc, the Google Doc, to preview this, we had all of the different previews set up. And when Jordan, I saw him open the doc, I saw his little cursor scroll to the bottom and just fill out everything on the AL Central showdown of Tigers versus Guardians. So you will be at all of these games as our Midwest correspondent. But there was something unbelievable, Jordan, about you opening the document and being like, Mets, Phillies? Nah.
Well, let's.
I know that was before the game was over. Yes. Nets, Phillies? I know. Dodgers, Padres? Nah. Yankees, Royals? Nah. I want the AL Central and I want it now.
This will be my job. I will be there on Friday for the workout day as the Tigers arrive here in Cleveland. Very excited for that. So this is also a new one. This is the first one, not just between Cleveland and Detroit, which we've never seen in the postseason, but just the AL Central in general. Since this division has existed in its form since 1994, we have never seen two AL Central teams play in the postseason. Think about that. That's a wild thing, right? We've seen all just in the last couple of years. Oh, here's the AL West showdown. Oh, here are the AL East, Yankees and Red Sox, and you know, or in this one game or in this shorter series. Oh, now we get to the CS. Happens all the time. Nope, not with these teams because, as we said, these teams have generally taken turns being very good, and the rest of them have been atrocious. And to have this many good AL Central teams at once for them to be three left, as you mentioned last year, it was deserved. They were on pace in August to be the worst division of all time. I think they narrowly avoided it, but here they are with three teams and a guaranteed team, at least one in the ALCS, which is really something to behold. But Guardians and Tigers is an interesting one because I did not get to see these two teams play in person this season. They had played much earlier this year, but this is an interesting one because this is, we would say this for a lot of the AL Central matchups, but you know, the inherent nature of these teams is, okay, these are the Midwest underdogs that have the small payroll and, you know, they're not supposed to be here, whatever. And Cleveland's been playing that role for a while, but they also just won the division by a bunch of games. And so they are still the favorite, and the Tigers have won the hearts of the neutral observer everywhere, right? I mean, obviously the Twins fans watching this are sick watching what's happening with Detroit and Cleveland, of course. But like anyone else is like, oh my God, this Tigers team is so fun, especially after they beat the Astros, right? Everyone's pulling for Detroit. And so that dynamic too is just like, who can kind of present themselves as the scrappier underdog is a pretty fun comparison. Ultimately, this series in the regular season was very, very, very close. Cleveland took 7 to Detroit 6, but Detroit outscored them 60-50 over those 13 games. And so it was very, very, very tight. And, you know, they're not built perfectly the same, but because of the relative lack of starting pitching after the number ones, boy, are we going to be seeing a lot of mixing and matching. After and because game one doesn't line up, right, we're not going to see Tarek Skubal in game one. at least one team is going to probably be going pretty heavy bullpen in pretty much all of these games.
The Tigers really did kind of steal Cleveland's thunder here. It's hilarious. It's like, yeah, we're going to just figure out how to score some runs, and our bullpen's going to be really good. And we don't know who's starting, but we play really sharp defense, and we don't make mistakes, and we put pressure on you on the bases. And we hope that works. Yeah. And Cleveland did that for 6 months, and Detroit kind of did that for 2 months. And here they are.
Yeah. And so, you know, I think, you know, we keep start comparing them. I mean, the offense is interesting. Detroit has found ways to score so much recently that enough to win all these games. So it feels like their offense is better than on paper it actually is. On the bases, the Tigers are number two in baseball in taking the extra base, you know, advancing first to third on a single, for example. But they're 26th in steals, whereas Cleveland is, you know, top 10 in both of those categories. So just overall base running impact is a little bit more balanced for Cleveland. And then in terms of power, I mean, both of these teams are way below everybody else in the playoff field, besides, I guess, Kansas City. Cleveland did hit a lot more home runs this year than they did last year. Last year, they were last in baseball by a ton, and obviously they just didn't have a very good season. This year, they were middle of the pack, but the overall offense is still below average, you know, batting average, below average on base, below average OPS. They don't walk very much at all. You know, they will chase a lot, and they don't hit the ball especially hard. But they have Jose Ramirez, and Jose Ramirez is one of the best players on earth. He almost went 40-40-40, 40 homers, 40 steals, 40 doubles, which had only been done by Alfonso Soriano, and maybe he would have done it if he got to play that last game that got rained out on Sunday. He's amazing. He's one of the best players in the world, and he's so much better than anyone Detroit has and anyone Cleveland has. And so when you're talking about these offenses, that is just the obvious place to start, and part of why Cleveland did end up winning the division by a bunch of games, because they do have a absolute game-changing offensive talent.
So the one difference between these two teams really is, I mean, there's a lot, but Cleveland runs aplenty, and the Tigers actually don't run as much as I thought. They're really good at holding runners, but they're not as aggressive on the bases as you might think. I'm excited to see if Cleveland, how much they're going to go for it on the bases. How are they going to take extra bases? Are they going to try and steal? That is going to be in a series like this for the real, like, this is the series for the real ball heads out there.
Yeah.
You don't need to know the name of whoever is pitching. That's irrelevant. All you need to know is that whoever's on first base might end up on third in a way you don't expect.
And to that point, I think the other narrative is maybe not exactly accurate, but Hinch versus Stephen Vogt is amazing, right? Hinch, who has proven been in these billion postseason games and just this masterclass of bullpen deployment, lineup construction, bench use, all these things we've seen. Stephen Vogt, this amazing managerial debut, which everyone in the clubhouse cannot speak, you know, more highly about the job that he's done as a manager. And yes, because of the way that Cleveland is built with their pitching staff, a lot of that has involved how he's used his bullpen in a lot of different ways, and sort of the same way as Detroit. But most of the things they talk about Vogt is just the mindset and just how he has quite literally managed this roster, this young team, expectations, the success that happened early, and just maintaining that when it got a little bit scary in mid-September, and then they surged back and won the division by a bunch of games. Clearly, this has been a masterful job. But Stephen Vogt has never managed in the postseason. And ultimately, now it is about those buttons that you are pressing. And that is where he will be scrutinized in ways that he is not yet, right? And so while he does have all these incredible pitchers at his disposal, and as good as Detroit's bullpen is, the upside with Cleveland, just because you have Clase, who is the best reliever on earth, certainly has been this season, and Cade Smith, who I also think is better than any reliever Detroit has. And listen, Detroit's relievers are really good. This is more about how highly I think of Cade Smith. They have all these other guys. Just how many, how they go through those is really interesting. And I think the last big X factor, two X factors for me, one is basically who throws like more than three innings that's not Tarek Skubal or Tanner Bibee. That is, it could be Matt Boyd, you know, facing a team in Detroit that he was, you know, played for most of his career. That's a compelling matchup. He's been really good for them and given them quality starts. Is it Reese Olson, who we still haven't seen yet from Detroit, you know, over these first couple games, and was a traditional starter for them? Is it another guy? We have Casey Mize or a Ty Madden, right? Is there another, you know, Cleveland starter, Gavin Williams, who pitched well against Detroit in the regular season? Do they trust him? I don't know. But there might be enough arms to just piece it together all the way through. So
yeah,
we will see. And that game one is just so big for Cleveland with Scuba looming in game two.
Tigers in three.
Tigers in three.
I'm in.
You're just like, Detroit can't lose.
I haven't seen it.
No, that's true. That's true. Again, in my picks, I had picked Houston. So like, that's out the door. So at this point, I am going to go with Cleveland. I think in four or five, I don't know. I think they're ready for this. I think that they do have enough other pitching and enough offense in the way that they do it to do it. But nothing's going to surprise me with Detroit anymore. Stephen Kwan is so important, right? I mean, he was really, really bad, after the All-Star break, had an injury, missed some time, came back, homered in his first pitch. But is he playing like an All-Star? Is Josh Naylor playing like an All-Star? Now the gap in the offense starts to become a lot bigger, but we have not seen really that version of those guys down the stretch. So we'll see. I'm going with Cleveland in four.
Throwing out the first pitch, Josh Tomlin in game two. And in game one, Travis Fryman, which is a fascinating pick because Travis Fryman played in the big leagues for, I'm just off the top of my head, I want to say 13 years, maybe 12 years. And I 13. Think he spent the overwhelming majority of that, I'll say 8 or 9 years with the Tigers and only like 4 or 5 years with the Guardians.
Eight with Detroit, 5 with Cleveland. So there you go. That is a very funny one.
It's a good coup there.
We'll see how they can go throw one out in Detroit for game three. Maybe we will see that as well.
I know that the Reds hired Terry Francona and I know it's super wonky. I am exhausted and I don't want to talk about it right now.
Yeah, that's fair.
Teams should not be allowed to announce managers during the playoffs. Sorry. Wait till November.
Yeah. I mean,
nothing going on then.
You blame Mark Feinstein for breaking it. And I guess we wouldn't have even known. I don't know when the Reds are going to announce this, but that's a whole other thing. I'm sure people will be talking about it at Progressive Field tomorrow. So I'll definitely report back after that. I do not know when we'll be podcasting again, but I look forward to it. I hope everyone enjoyed this Oh My God Mets recap and DS preview. Thank you to Andrew Hartz for once again staying up late to produce this. We appreciate all the support. If you like this podcast, tell a friend. Tell a baseball-loving friend that we're having a good time here at Baseball Barbercast and email us at baseballbarbercast@gmail.com after you tell a friend and leave a rating or review and let us know what you think of the show because we're having a good time and that's what October is all about. Final thoughts, Jake Mintz.
Someone tweeted a picture of moving the Milwaukee clubhouse people, moving the champagne
I retweeted
the beer.
This picture.
From one clubhouse to the other. And that, to me, what a rare, beautiful sight. Everyone have a great couple days. We'll talk soon.